listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we look at the ongoing protests in North Dakota over the Dakota Access Pipeline.
First, the idea of life beyond Earth is one that's fascinated humans for centuries. These days, stories about aliens and creatures from beyond are all over TV and the big screen. Most recently, NASA itself expressed renewed optimism about finding evidence of life on Mars, but it's not the only possible option on the table. Which raises the question, if you had to choose where to send a mission to look for life, where would you pick?
Well, it's an intriguing question, especially when you start thinking about humanity's available resources and funding. So maybe it would help to narrow down the scope a bit. And that's where our next guest comes in. In a new book, he lays out some plausible scenarios for finding extraterrestrial life, the pros and cons of each one, and what life could look like in each case.
John Willis joins us now. He's an associate professor of astronomy at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. He's the author of All These Worlds Are Yours, The Scientific Search for Alien Life. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Well, John, you start off the book with two big statements here. You say aliens exist and there is life beyond planet Earth, probably lots of it. Why could we be confident about that?
Well, that's correct. Well, it's a mathematical argument, and it's basically an unsatisfying one. And it's something your listeners may well have heard before. And the idea is that the universe is a big place, and it's quite possibly infinite in size. It's certainly bigger than we can see just with our limited horizon. And if you want to play that game of having an infinite universe, then it doesn't matter how small you think the possibility of life beyond Earth is. If it exists, if it's a number, no matter how tiny, then it's got to occur somewhere.
And that's a pretty big starting assumption, but is that enough to launch a probe or a satellite to look for this kind of thing? Are we dedicated to finding this life?
Well, it's not a good enough reason, and that's why you kind of ask a different question. And the different question is, do we have any scientific evidence for life beyond Earth? And the answer to that question is just as resounding a no. And the book is really about how are you actually going to go about tackling that second question, because that's the more interesting one, because that involves actually finding evidence of life, studying it, and learning something about it.
So let's talk about life before we talk about looking for it. I mean, thinking about it in the movie form, we might imagine somebody pulling up in a big spaceship asking for some spare plutonium, but life could be some really, really simple single-celled organism or something like that, couldn't it?
Well, that's probably, based upon what we know from life on Earth, that's the balance of probability, is that when we go out, especially into the solar system with remote probes and go investigating possible habitats, we're much more likely to find primitive, basic, quite hardy life rather than what we would call complex life.
And in setting up your argument before, you know, getting us over our idea of what aliens look like, you also talk about where to look based on what conditions are necessary to form life based on what we know on good old planet Earth. So what do we know about that?
Well, every living creature on planet Earth, whether the smallest microbe or the biggest blue whale, needs essentially three ingredients to keep on living. And that's liquid water, or if you wanted to be more general, some kind of liquid medium in which to perform its chemistry, organic chemicals, that are kind of the raw materials of life, and some source of energy to keep it all going. And so the simplest thing we can take from planet Earth is that if we see beyond Earth those three conditions met, that's a potential habitat we should be investigating.
Talking to John Willis, his new book is All These Worlds Are Yours, The Scientific Search for Alien Life. And a lot of what you're doing is kind of almost a triage, I guess, of the search for life. In an infinite universe, we have to pick and choose where to invest our energy. Why is that important as a first step?
Well, I mean, I could have written a book where I talked about all of the possibilities, endless possibilities, but the reader, I'd be doing the reader a disservice, because you've got to help them, give them the education to winnow away at those ideas, to actually get the wheat from the chaff. And one of the best ways to focus someone's minds on that question is just to remind them we have limited resources. We can't fund space missions everywhere in the solar system. We can't go to every nook and cranny. So the question is, if I gave you a reasonable amount of money equivalent to a major space mission, well, after reading the book, where would you as the reader want to put your money?
And it seems like one obvious starting point might be Mars. For one thing, we've thought that there might be life there in the past, and there's sort of this cultural imagination around it. But also, it looks like there was evidence of water on Mars, at least at one point. So maybe there was life in the past, maybe the distant past there. So what about Mars?
Mars is really enigmatic, and it's a great option. And unsurprisingly, that's why we're sending so many probes to Mars, both to orbit it and explore the surface with rovers, this kind of thing. Because certainly when you look back in its distant past, and when I say distant, I mean really early in Mars's history, say between 3 and 4 billion years ago, when the evidence that we have for Mars at the moment shows that in all respects, it seemed to be quite similar to Earth. We believe it had large amounts of liquid water on the surface. It had some kind of thick atmosphere that enabled that liquid water to exist. And we believe that those are the same kinds of conditions that were prevalent on Earth. And so if, as we have evidence for, life on Earth 3 billion years ago, then it naturally poses the question, well, did life arise on Mars as well? And could we find evidence for that today? So that's a really interesting option.
And with our current efforts on Mars, with the Mars rovers out there, are we putting a lot of priority into searching for evidence of life, a past or more likely present on Mars?
Well, what I would do is I would say it's more what we're exploring Mars at the moment in the context of really basic planetary exploration. Okay, there are so many questions that we don't know about Mars, don't know the answers to about Mars, that really we're doing a lot of basic research. And if you can think about it, that basic research is almost like examining the haystack. And all of the strands of straw are interesting. They give us some kind of knowledge. Life, if it exists on Mars, is kind of the needle in the haystack, that in doing that basic exploration, we're going to find something one day, possibly, that doesn't make sense, doesn't add up with what we expect. And that might be the kind of clue we're looking for.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Mark with us in New Berlin. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You asked where I would look if I was asking you to store, I had money to spend. I would look at it two ways. I would look at orbiting or extraterrestrial telescopes to look at planets that transit their star, and we can look at their atmospheres spectrographically to determine whether or not they'd have things that would be associated with life, at least as we know it. The other thing I would do is I would have a probe or multiple probes going to the Galilean moons on Jupiter, as well as Titan on Saturn, liquid methane, liquid water on both of those atmospheres. I think the one thing that we're probably wasting our time on is radio telescoping, looking for signals, because as we're seeing on our own planet, as electronics advance, the level and the powers transmitted for radio and television is actually dropping, and it's becoming more directional, and we're not just broadcasting it all over the universe.
Mark, thanks a lot. Lots of great thoughts there. He seems to be on the right track in a lot of ways, at least in line with what you're thinking, John. So what about some of Mark's ideas, including pointing telescopes there, doing some analysis about signs of alien life, and using things like rovers and probes?
Well, Mark is clearly a very well-informed listener, and he's read the book in some detail because he's nailed all the major points of the book there in one series of comments. I have no problem with what he says.
Let's narrow it down a little bit, and the next further out, a moon around Jupiter, you think, would be a potential scenario for finding life?
Well, I think I know what you're getting at there. And so, I mean, really, if you were to ask people a very simple question, where do you think most of the liquid water resides in the solar system, right? I think before I asked that question in such a suspicious way, most people would say planet Earth, okay? Mm. But it turns out not to be the case. It turns out to be one of the moons of Jupiter, Europa, that when you actually look at the results of analysis from the Galileo space probe, and work out how much water these results point to, it's about 2 times the volume of liquid water that exists on Earth is underneath the ice of that moon in orbit around Jupiter.
So that seems like a fertile place to start, but I mean, this is all covered in ice, so if you want to ascertain whether or not there's life there, how do you get a sample? How do you get close enough and get what you need?
Well, you've really got 2 options. One is drill for all you're worth, okay? That is, once you've actually got your drilling rig all the way out to Jupiter and landed it safely on Europa. And that's a tall order, because even at the moment, we don't know exactly how thick the ice sheet is on Europa. Might be 5 kilometers, might be 10, might be 30 kilometers. And that's starting to become a pretty tall order. Option two is only possibly slightly less difficult, but I think it's quite achievable, and that's go one planet further out to Saturn, where there's a slightly smaller ice moon called Enceladus that we believe has a similar liquid water ocean or reservoir underneath its icy surface. The difference there is that the Cassini space probe has imaged geysers of water, in this case water vapor and ice crystals, venting out through the crack, through cracks on the south pole of Enceladus, actually taking some of that sub ice water and venting it into space, where a suitable probe could actually capture some of that material and possibly analyze it, or even more boldly, return it to Earth.
We're talking with astronomy professor John Willis about the search for alien life in our solar system, around the universe, and where we might possibly find it in the coming decades. John is the author of the new book, All These Worlds Are Yours.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you were in charge of a life-finding mission for NASA, maybe another space agency, where would you look? And why? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How invested or excited are you in the idea of finding life elsewhere in the universe? You can let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you in just a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time.
We're talking to astronomy professor John Willis. He's the author of the new book, All These Worlds Are Yours, The Scientific Search for Alien Life. And we're looking at the most likely places in the universe where alien life could exist.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you got put in charge of the budget for finding life elsewhere in the solar system or beyond, where do you think we should start? Mars? Some of the moons of Jupiter or Saturn? Extrasolar planets? If we do find life, what do you think that'll mean for humans and our place in the universe? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take our next caller now. Chance is with us in Osseo. Hi there.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just calling in regard to the previous caller who recommended the elimination of radio telescopes, and the guests seemed to agree. And I haven't read the book, and I'm not an expert on these things, but my understanding was that because of our current technology, it's unlikely to find just randomly broadcast radio waves emitting from some distant celestial object. But doesn't it stand to reason that aliens also, or, you know, extraterrestrial life also, if they had technology, it went through an evolution, and that they indeed, at one time, we're also transmitting random radio waves throughout the universe?
Okay, Chance, what do you think about that, John?
Well, I think that's a great point, and I should clarify my earlier statement that I certainly wouldn't recommend closing down any of these projects that, under which we all call them SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. I mean, my position is, in the book at least, is slightly more particular. So I wouldn't spend any of my money on it. I put my money onto what I think are better options, space probes to the moons of the solar system, and a particularly impressive telescope. Okay, but I'm really pleased that some people are willing to put their money where their mouth is and actually fund these projects. In particular, I'm thinking of the Breakthrough Foundation that's funding, to the tune of about $100 million, the Breakthrough Listen project, which is essentially private money which is underwriting the SETI program. And I certainly don't rule out the fact that we're going to detect an alien signal that way. But on the whole, I'd be surprised. Okay, that's kind of my personal position. And it's not one you can really come up with a huge amount of equations to support. But it's really the fact that as the caller points out, that at some point in their past history, any advanced alien civilization, if it exists, may well have been broadcasting randomly into space. But the question is, how likely is that over the volume of space over which we'd be sensitive to those signals? And that's really a number that nobody is able to work out in any rigorous way. And that's one of the issues I have with SETI. And as I say, because of that, if I was limited to $4 billion, I'd probably put my money elsewhere. But the fact that other people are willing to fund it and take that chance, I'm completely happy with.
Thanks for that call. And John, I wonder, with looking the idea of trying to detect life outside the solar system, we're getting pretty good, it seems like, at detecting planets. We have some idea like where the planet could be, what size, that it might be able to sustain life. But if we're assuming a non-technological alien life form on another planet, do we have anywhere near the kind of technology we would need to detect something like that?
We do, and we're getting better every day. I mean, what technique you would use to try and identify life on one of these extrasolar planets is to look and see if it has an atmosphere. Okay. Now, as you mentioned, we can measure some things about these planets already. We can measure, in some cases, their masses, their sizes, and from that we can get their density. And we can say, well, does it have the density of rock? Is it like a rocky planet like Earth? Or is it the density of gas like Jupiter or Saturn? Okay, so we can tell something about the physical nature of the planet. And if we happen to find a rocky planet that has an atmosphere on it, well, we're just now at the stage where our technology is able to take a spectrum of the starlight as it passes through the atmosphere of that planet, as once every orbit the planet passes in front of its parent star. And once we do that, we actually get, for a brief moment, a glimpse through the atmosphere. And that gives us kind of a fingerprint of the chemical elements that may be present in that atmosphere. And what you're really looking for, once again, is you may have to look at thousands of planets and their atmospheres, and you'll start to learn about all the different physics that determines how those atmospheres are made up. And in one or two cases, I think, you're going to find some surprises, some oddballs, that needle in the haystack again. And that's what we're going to focus on. We're going to look at those and say perhaps there might be abundant atmospheric oxygen or methane beyond what we would expect. And those are going to be, I wouldn't say unambiguous cases of potentially life on those planets, but those oddballs are the ones we're going to follow up.
We're talking with John Willis right now, Associate Professor of Astronomy at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, talking about his new book, All These Worlds Are Yours, The Scientific Search for Alien Life, trying to narrow down the possibilities for where in the universe to look to find alien life. And we'll take our next caller now. We've got Steve with us in Madison. Steve, hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. It might be something I just read about in science fiction 40 years ago, but I'm wondering whether anyone who's seriously informed is looking at alternate to carbon-based life forms, if anyone is considering the existence of silicon-based life forms or others that don't require water, so that you could look on extraterrestrial objects where they don't have water, that you might find some life form other than carbon-based.
Steve, thanks a lot. What about that non-carbon-based life forms, John?
Well, that's a really good question. And, I mean, and as the caller points out, this has been discussed as, you know, all the wide variety of possibilities for life have been discussed really well in science fiction, okay, and that's great for firing the imagination. In terms of actually understanding life in a laboratory environment, at the moment we're really limited, and we're limited by what we know about Earth life. And the saying I keep telling my students and my classes is, you've got to start with what you know, okay? So we're starting to look for primitive life in the solar system that is broadly similar to Earth-based life. And you might well say, correctly, well, that's a really narrow perspective. You know, what happens if there's some kind of weird, funky life out there that doesn't match your expectations? You won't find it, and that's correct. But really, you've got to start with some known template. Try and push it. Push your assumptions in any way possible. For example, you might look for carbon-based life, not in liquid water, but as one earlier caller pointed out, in liquid methane or ethane on Saturn's moon Titan. But you really got to start with what you know about life and then start to push the envelope of those assumptions. That's kind of the current strategy.
We've been talking mostly about the how and where, John, of finding alien life. You also write a little bit about when, you know, whether we're talking a decade or 100 years or 1,000 years before we humans find some other form of life. Ballpark, what are you thinking? What's your bet?
Oh, my bet. Christ, what odds are you giving me?
I'll let you set the odds.
I think if you were to choose between 10 years, 100 years, and 1,000 years, for me, 100 years is a challenging timescale. And I don't mean challenging because it's necessarily impossibly difficult, because it challenges us as human beings and scientists and engineers to actually come up with ideas, to fund them and fly them, and actually go to the locations in the solar system that we think are promising options at the moment, and actually perform rigorous tests in those locations. 100 years is about long enough to do that across the solar system. And whether we'll find something, even if we don't, we're going to learn an awful lot about the possible rarity of life or otherwise.
And you seem, especially at the end of your book, John, pretty bullish about the largest moon of Saturn, Titan. What is it about Saturn? Is that where you might be persuaded to put a bet?
Is that where all the action is? Yeah, I'd certainly throw a, as I talk in the book, I think the idea of going to the, not Titan, but in particular Enceladus, and actually flying through these plumes of material, these geysers, and collecting material from them, that's a really compelling option. It's almost like you're getting a free sample of a habitat under these ice sheets. Titan is different altogether, and that's what makes it so interesting. It's not so much that it's cold, it's that there is abundant liquid on the surface. It's liquid methane and liquid ethane. And so if there is life on Titan, it's going to do exactly what I mentioned to your previous question. It's going to push our assumptions about what life can possibly be into interesting new directions. And so it would be wrong of me to talk about the probability of finding life there. I have no idea about the probability. But if we do find some kind of organisms on Titan, they're going to be amazingly interesting compared to anything we've ever seen on Earth.
John, thank you so much for taking the time with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
We've been talking to John Willis. He's an associate professor of astronomy at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. He's the author of the new book, All These Worlds Are Yours, The Scientific Search for Alien Life. Well, tell us where you think we should be spending our limited resources to look for life in the solar system and beyond. Tweet us at Central Time WPR, or as always, you can send us a message on the Central Time Facebook page.